Hey, folks, and welcome to the Daily Ratings Podcast. It's a show where each week we'll be sitting down with Vincent Daly to get his thoughts on the latest movies he's been watching, both older films and new releases. And don't worry, there's no spoilers. Vince will give a brief review of the movie, share some thoughts, and of course, then rate the film. The Daily Ratings are always fair, honest, and most importantly, they're consistent. On today's show, Vince will be rating and reviewing. We have The Beach, directed by Danny Boyle. Sunshine, directed by Danny Boyle. We then have Ex Machina and Annihilation, directed by Alex Garland. And finally, newly released, now in theaters, Civil War, again directed by Alex Garland. So we are wrapping up our Alex Garland study this week, folks. Stay tuned and enjoy. Mr. Vincent Daly, how we doing, buddy?
Tommy, how's it going?
It's going okay on my end of the table. And how was your Alex Garland week, man?
Oh, man. A delightful week. I loved this week.
Okay, good, good.
This is a lot of movies that I've seen many, many times. A lot of sci-fi.
Yeah, a lot of sci-fi.
And yeah, I mean, I was able to appreciate a lot of what Alex Garland does as a writer, not necessarily even a director, but yeah, a lot of what he does as a writer with watching all these movies, especially those early ones, because you really see...
He is just a writer, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But definitely one of my favorite sci-fi creators, and a week that was definitely challenging to write about, kind of wrap my head around how...
Oh, I honestly thought this was going to be a little bit easier for you.
Just because, I don't know, I find there's a difficulty in writing about something that I've seen so many times.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Almost how we kind of encountered with the No Country for Old Men special, where it's like, where do I start? You know what I mean? How do I even approach it from spoilers versus no spoilers when you've seen something so many times and you kind of know it like the back of your hand?
You're right, you kind of know what the deal is.
Exactly.
Was it fun returning to everything?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love a lot of these movies. And, you know, folks, let's talk about what isn't here in the week. He, of course, wrote 28 Days Later, which we covered on our zombie special, a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
Also with Danny Boyle. So they are kind of...
They really a team.
Yeah, absolutely. We aren't covering some of his middle writing projects. That specifically means we're not covering 2012's Dread, even though it's probably the best of those 80s spun into 2010 remakes.
Right. He wrote that.
Yeah,
He directed as well or no?
No.
Just wrote, okay.
Just wrote. Also does some video game work during that time. I mean, I like Dread a lot. It's probably the best out of the three that are these like flips from the 80s to the 2010s.
We did RoboCop too, is that right?
Yeah, RoboCop, Total Recall,
right,
and
right,
Dread,
yep.
I feel like all are within that same wheelhouse. I'll mention it. We already covered 2022's Men on the podcast.
Yep.
So already rated. And I'll just give a slight shout out to the 2020 miniseries Devs, a show I've been honestly wanting to check out for years now that he does. But just, you know, I'm not DV guy.
Right. You know, don't have enough time on your hands anymore.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if we had less movies to cover, I think... a reality that this might have, Devs might have been included in the week of review, but we'll see. We'll see in the future if I incorporate
that would be
a TV miniseries into stuff.
I'll tell you what, what's going to be the one that cracks it, you know? What's going to break the mold?
Right.
We're getting into territory on that one if we get to jump into TV.
Right, exactly. That opens the floodgates.
I did start Fallout's show.
Oh, yeah. With, of course, your boy, Walter Goggins.
Yeah. It's not bad.
Yeah?
It's not terrible.
I mean, unusually good things about the CGI, actually. So I'm kind of interested to check it out for that reason.
It's good. Well, and you're a big proponent of the games, at least in the earlier days.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, he's a hometown boy, the guy who created it all. Right, Todd?
Oh,
Phillips,
yeah, Todd Howard. Yeah. Todd Howard is a local boy. And further breadcrumbs to dox ourselves throughout the episodes of the podcast.
But Walter Goggins is great in it because he's Walter Goggins.
Yes.
Like, he is getting so popular now.
I know. Yeah. He's,
I'd love to see his fame rise because he's filming season 3 of White Lotus right now.
Really?
Yeah. He's going to be the main cast.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, with all that, let's just get into the last of our Alex Garland stuff. So, and I'll say right away, I watched Sunshine, Annihilation, I've watched Ex Machina before, so The Beach and Civil War are kind of question marks for me.
Sure.
Let's jump back to 2000, like we said, Danny Boyle. Is this the film he did after Trainspotting?
I think there's one in between, but you're dead on the money.
Okay.
It's very recent.
So, this is a very young Leo. Tilly is in it. This is called The Beach. And what we talked about, I think, when we did Blood Diamond as well the other day, or last 2 weeks ago, whenever that was. It's
the other day.
This is one of the Leo ones that kind of fall into a hole that people forget about.
Yes.
You know?
Right. We'll call it post-Titanic syndrome for Leo.
Because it's so soon after?
Yeah. And I feel like Titanic was so, like, changed people's lives. You
it
know
did.
What I mean?
Well, it kind of goes Titanic and then Catch Me If You Can is how people think about Leo.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's one in between, 2000, called The Beach. Let's get into it. Tell us a little bit about it and how'd you like it?
Well, this is one of those huge fan favorite movies, folks, especially for a young Leo DiCaprio fueling the interest. Like I said, post-Titanic means he's really just could not be bigger in the mainstream interest as a star in Hollywood, but also a movie that is critically panned for its pop culture appeal, being skewered for having little substance in its, I guess we'll say, this kind of vacation party shell, and not earning its intense moments. Part of that is also around some controversy with this film. I guess during the production, there was like some serious damage to the island they were filming on.
Oh, okay.
Criticism like that definitely come and go. Feeling much more intense, you know, when the movie is coming out.
Right.
And then kind of just being an afternote to some sort of pop culture knowledge about the film after the fact. This all makes for a movie, though, that I'm interested to check out, to call heads or tails if, it's worth it at all. I've never seen The Beach. This was definitely one of those movies where I had it on. Or I didn't have it on. My sister had it on VHS, probably for Leo. You know, with plenty of distance between its release date, see how it holds up like kind of 20 years in between. Without this movie, we might not have any of what we're covering this episode. The Beach sparks the collaboration between director Danny Boyle and Alex Garland writing. That will develop 2 years later to give us the, once again, fantastic zombie film 28 Days Later. And especially for our next film in the episode Sunshine in 2007. The Beach is also before Garland is a screenwriter in any sort of way, and long before he had his directorial debut. This is one of three books he wrote, the other two being The Tesseract and The Coma. I think also The Tesseract gets a small adaptation as well. Kind of interesting as far as Alex Garland is really writer first when it comes to kind of taking these concepts and bringing them to live on screen. So
yeah, I mean, I had no idea that he wrote books.
Yeah.
I literally had no clue.
And interesting enough, stops writing books then. He hasn't written anything since.
He sticks to scripts at that point.
Yeah, he's just like, I'm done, you know. In this story, we see Leo DiCaprio play a thrill-seeking backpacker searching for equal parts pleasure and purpose in life. While in Thailand, he picks up a rumor that changes his life forever, a mysterious beach on a secluded island that promises an experience almost too good to be true. Turns out, the beach is 100% real, but the fellow adventure seekers are a little too keen on keeping their island a little secret. In fact, everyone might just be a selfish prick in this movie. that's kind of my hot takeaway. It's just like, wow, no one cares about anything other than themselves. Leo gives a heavy narration here as he plunges deeper into the fantasy of the beach, like some sort of teenage Apocalypse Now. That's 2 weeks in a row I was able to pull Apocalypse Now out. And surprisingly, this shows a slight theme in this week's movies of characters driven by madness or driven to madness. Here we explore how infinite leisure might drive someone a little crazy. And no less how that affects the groupthink of a collective group of people experiencing the same high of true freedom on this island, and what that may do to their priorities, what that may do to their morals and ethics. I would say, as a positive, Danny Boyle is no stranger to needle drop heavy licensed soundtracks, especially coming off of the 1996 must watch Trainspotting. Here we get a cool soundtrack with a lot of early 2000s vibes, most notably dreamy tracks from Moby and DJ Shadow and many more. I really dig this. I mean, obviously, I'm a little nostalgic of that music, but
it transported you back a little bit, a little time capsule.
Absolutely. Yeah. I thought it was an enjoyable aspect of this, where something like Sunshine we'll touch on in a little bit. It almost showed its age in a tiny bit of a bad way, where this, I don't know, I think the age kind of added to the enjoyment of the film. And it's just so odd to feel that with a 2000s movie. You know, I'm plenty used to talking about that, about the 90s, 80s, 70s, but
it's been long enough now. Two and a half decades.
Exactly. Soon we'll be getting 2000s nostalgia shoved in our face on every movie. So when it comes to the island itself is where I have issues with the story. It's not so much that I want to pick a fight with the logic of why they're staying on the island, even though I will say it's pretty stupid when the rules are just kind of laid flat out. It's more so how shallow the concept is explored in the movie, and it splits its time with this like love triangle. Now, don't get me wrong, this obviously had to focus on a romance plot. I think that's where the context of where Leo is in his career, what has been the most successful movie in the 90s, the Titanic, you know what I mean? It had to be a romance in some way. And that's probably the sole draw for the film for a lot of audiences at the time. Mm-hmm. But the runtime just doesn't give it a chance to impress. And I actually think this could have been a touch longer to let all the themes marinate. I really would have been fine with this being a good 30 minutes longer. And that way it doesn't feel like it's rushing through any of the camps, of the themes of whether it be the romance plot, whether it be kind of Leo's character wanting to seek thrills and joy and kind of find purpose, or where the film ultimately goes with more of its intense twists and turns.
Right.
Also, this angle of jungle madness is very weak, very thin, and comes out of nowhere. And really a perfect example of just give me a little bit more time. I mean, let me believe that he's going crazy. I think even in the film itself, the where this comes out of is like it's been like 3 days, and it's just like what? That doesn't feel right. That doesn't feel appropriate.
That's funny. I might have some of those comments coming up in those films. I didn't realize this was such a DNA of his.
Yeah.
That just characters going mad, basically going crazy. I mean, we'll find out what happens in Civil War, but that's, I guess, the country going crazy.
You're right, right, exactly. It really was something that I uncovered throughout the week. He likes the premise of characters acting. Probably they've gone crazy in the process of that.
It's the driving force in our next three films.
Yeah, exactly. You know, visually, there's some cool things done during this segment of the film, including a Crash Bandicoot-style video game sequence. I mean, obviously, I'll kind of give hats off to Danny Boyle for being very creative, as he always is. But to me, it felt like the story shifted to become something entirely else without laying the groundwork to get there. And once again, I felt a perfect solution would just be giving it some runtime to develop these themes and get something more. I hate to even compare this to it, but like Immaculate a few weeks ago, it had things going for it. None of them just are beyond surface level, if
right.
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Overall, though, I'm walking away not too satisfied on this one. Both in the film and my own goals to call heads or tails, and if it's worth seeing it, you know, 20 years later, I really feel like this movie works exactly how it was positioned back in 2000. An intense, dopamine-fueled romance designed to give audiences what they want most. Leo on a beach without a shirt as long as possible. We're going to go ahead and give The Beach 2000 a 59.
Okay, 59. So not complete trash.
No, not at all.
You know, I mean, it has its... It must have been interesting during the time of it coming out, because people must have been... He might have done a small role in between this and the Titanic as well. Mm-hmm. But he could do anything he wanted to right now at this time.
Right.
You know
Bingo.
What I mean?
Bingo.
This had talk when it was coming out and be like the next big thing. Well, what, and by the way, what is our supporting cast? I mean, he has a main love interest, presumably, and then he has Tilda Swinton. Where does she fit in?
Kind of in the love triangle of it. Also, Tilda Swinton is the leader of this commune on
the beach.
So there's a kind of a power play there. You know, really no notes with anyone else, though, just because it really is about Leo. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, it's what audiences wanted. And I feel like the film has priorities in a good place when it comes to that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's jump ahead. That was 2000. We're going to jump ahead to 2007 now. We're still with Danny Boyle.
Mm.
So he does The Beach. I didn't realize how much he was pumping out, kind of.
Oh, yeah.
Because he does The Beach, presumably... Well, then he does 28 Days Later.
Bingo.
And then another film, and then Sunshine?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 2007 Sunshine. We're covering it because Alex Garland's writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And not a book, but just a script. And we see a young Cillian Murphy and some other recognizable faces.
A lot of recognizable faces.
Why don't we get into it? And we'll go back and forth a little bit on this one.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be honest, and I'll say I'm a little generous on scoring this film, but that's because I am an avid lover of sci-fi with a hard science spin here. On this rewatch, I felt the movie... has some age to it. It's aged more than expected on this one.
Okay, all right.
The 2000s had its own feel for these type of movies, and this very much fits in it for better or worse. This is now the third project that Danny Boyle directs, teaming up with Alex Garland, now getting the full screenwriting credit. And my appreciation of the film starts with just loving how tight the story is. If anything, completely avoiding what I felt with The Beach, in that this has every story element playing into each other for the runtime.
Hmm.
A lot of that comes from being stuck on a ship. A lot of that comes from, you know, kind of a focus of these crew members are all serving a very specific role, a la Star Trek style. For me, it was a tight script that everything was used, basically. Nothing was set up and then not used.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
That's for sure. There's a absolute simplicity of being on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And watching it now after the fact, I'm starting to maybe get jaded with just this whole concept of crew on ship. Everyone has their parts. We're all going to get an eating scene somewhere in the beginning. I mean,
It's just 79.
It's Alien, and it's every other film after Alien that has to do anything with this.
Bingo.
You know what I mean?
Bingo.
You know, we break it up a little bit. We talked about Moon the other week because we were watching Spaceman. So it's like very small crew on a ship. You know, there's definitely not a lot of fat there, but it is a little bit of rinse repeat because we have, you know, we have the mechanic, we've got the pilot, we've got the captain, we've got the medical guy. You know, it's all okay. All the work's, you know, the gears are there.
Right.
You know, we're just kind of rolling.
Right. Exactly. And I think that comes down to a conversation of sci-fi can be formulaic in its structure. You know, this is very much like a bottle ship type of story where we're trapped on the ship and
it is a lot of sci-fi too.
Complications, you know, and what is the mover in those type of stories as well?
Yeah.
Like, is it stuff happening to the ship? Is it infighting within the crew? And usually
those are your options. Those are your options. I mean, gravity.
Yeah. Yep. Bingo.
Even life with Jake Gyllenhaal. It's
not good,
but it's all. We have a lot of these kinds of stories. I think.
Exactly.
I was excited to approach this, though, for sure.
And I think where that cliche starts is in this 2000s field, where you're going to be getting kind of almost what feel like leftover scripts from the 90s, and trying to get a blockbuster sci-fi action.
Yeah.
I feel that also plays in with a lot more commercially successful stuff like Armageddon or like Deep Impact and stuff like that, like disaster style movies. So that's where I'm coming from as far as like calling this like a 2000 feel and showing its age. That's exactly what I'm tuning into.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that makes sense. Yeah.
Sunshine is about a sci-fi suicide mission named Icarus to jumpstart the sun in a desperate act to save humanity from extinction set in 2057. Shockingly enough, this is the second mission attempting to do so, which cascades fear of what happened to the first Icarus mission. Like I've said, you know, a few times already, very much a bottle ship style setup. We get to know the crew, their roles as specialists, and how they live during this critical mission. I think in a very good way, what I appreciate about this film is that the story and pacing are pulled in opposite directions to create tension. This all-or-nothing style mission to save our son is offset by not a relaxed, but kind of a fatalist attitude within the crew, as they know this is likely their final days, whether they're successful or not. For some of the gravity of their actions, that's top of mind. For others, they kind of lack that same focus. And complications in both the ship and the mission force these characters to be tested as more and more harsh realities of their success are unveiled for the crew. As far as a sci-fi goes, I think this explores a lot of genuine unknowns in what would happen being this close to the sun. And this approach had me thinking of probably the strongest doubleheader I've come up with since you coined the term doubleheader.
Yes, as I couldn't come up with the word double feature on the movie podcast. Yeah, I only could come up with doubleheader.
Which I love. It will always be doubleheader.
I feel like a lot could be paired with this. What did you have in mind?
I would say definitely Interstellar, 100%.
Okay.
It's the same type of suicide mission. Mission to save, focus on realism, but also maybe gets a little
supernatural
towards its conclusion. You know, much like Chris Nolan's Interstellar, some of this approach is hyper-realism towards the science, towards the ships and things like that, while other aspects are more ethereal and leave room for imagination in the story, and once again, especially in both films' conclusions. For that reason, I would pair these two movies together for more than their mission to save humanity style plot. It's because they strike a balance between science and fiction, and kind of equal time spent in both.
I agree with that too, especially just from the aspect of where it's a mission to save something back on Earth. To me, I don't know. Interstellar is such a massive movie compared to this.
Okay,
you know what I mean? Like, some other stuff comes into mind first because, I feel like there's so many kind of comparable films. But Interstellar works.
Yeah. And I guess when it boils down, it is for that, you know, save humanity type of space mission.
Right.
You know, they're one-way trip, basically, is the assumption. Certainly, movies in space are no stranger to good casting work, but look at this cast, man. I mean, a killer list of before they were big and famous. Some connective tissue, which, of course, we always love on the podcast. Cillian Murphy is coming off of working with Danny Boyle on 28 Days Later. And then, of course, Rose Byrne goes on to star in 28 Weeks Later and a lot of bad horror movies. So there's that, but certainly a recognizable face. Chris Evans is just coming off of the Fantastic Four, dipping his toe into Marvel and pre-Marvel for Benedict Wong as well, who we'll actually see Benedict Wong in Annihilation?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So working with him again, or Garland again. And we see Michelle Yeoh here with nearly all of her famous kung fu films under her belt, but just starting to crack into Hollywood projects. Mm-hmm. Who do you think is the strongest of the crew?
For that time period?
Sure, the movie itself. Watching
it now.
Yeah.
It's hard not to say Cillian.
Oh, okay.
Chris Evans is funny because like he plays a douche, and he, like that's the vibe he gets off in real life a little bit too.
Yeah.
So that's very
fitting.
And we
have seen he can only act in that capacity as well as a recent look.
And then, how do you also say Hiroyuki Sanada?
Yes.
And he's big in the new Shogun movie, Shogun series right now.
That's right.
So a lot of familiar faces, even like Mark Strong makes an appearance.
Yep.
So a lot of familiar faces. I would say Cillian probably is my favorite.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would say, much like Dune 2, I need a second to just kind of freak out about sci-fi shit with this.
Please.
Because this was really always the deep cut movie that I really appreciate the real science behind it. The Icarus 2 is an awesome ship design, striking a balance between real tech and concept. I absolutely love this like solar battering ram on the front of the ship.
Yeah.
Just so cool. Also, the presentation of, you know, the power of the sun is conveyed so drastically too. Anytime we're in the shade of the ship, it's the usual kind of void of space, but put us in front and the scene turns into this deafening blur of energy and sells us on how just deadly the mission is. I feel like that's also another aspect of like Yeah, I guess a lot of writers could imagine what it would be to get close to the sun, probably areas that have been explored in 60s television like Twilight Zone and Star Trek. But when it comes down to it having gravity on screen and it, you know, being a catalyst for every decision, every domino that falls in the film, I just feel like it's such a tight little script when it comes to that.
I would agree. I mean, because for me watching it, things were happening so fast mm-hmm. that I was upset they weren't fleshed out more. And I felt like our characters didn't get hit enough, whether it be emotionally or freaked out or scared or things. As soon as something happened, boom, our cast is back at something else and we're over and we're moving on.
Yeah.
And to me, there was almost like a lack of stakes a little bit. So I agree there was almost no fat. I almost wish it's almost too lean.
What you're saying with my comments on the beach.
I think it could have probably added a half an hour. I just think, I don't know. Do you get any of that? Can you see how I was getting that?
Absolutely. I think, if anything, the crew's a touch too large for us to focus intimately on people? No?
No, I don't think it was the crew number. I just wanted maybe a little bit more heart. I wanted it to be, when things happen, I want it to be more impactful.
Oh, okay.
But I understand that we're just rolling along, we're solving problems, and things are getting done. But no one seems to be affected by anything.
Right.
True, like, you know what I mean?
True. Save for maybe like two characters, but I'm with you in the sense, like, I don't know. They are just so focused on the mission that maybe we lose the impact of them maybe losing their shit.
That's what I was getting from it.
Yeah.
I felt like there was a bit of a disconnect there because I didn't feel like it's like I wanted a little bit more realism there or a little bit something from the heart, more depth, more
a little too cold
emotional impact. Yeah. That being said, though, it moves on along in a clip. Like it is, we're just going. Especially when things kind of get started, when a flip a switch, something initially happens, it's just like, okay.
Yeah.
It's just one thing after another.
Absolutely.
So you're right. There is no fat.
Yeah.
I just think I'm looking to put more fat on.
Right. And I guess that's where I kind of come from in the appreciation of, like, a tight script has a good ramp. You know what I mean? It's ramping all the time.
Yeah.
We're not really taking a step backwards, both like in the journey, literally towards the sun. You know what I mean? There's no steps backwards.
Certainly
in progress
not. That is,
or plot, you know?
That is absolutely true. Yeah.
Yeah. I really do love the specialist international mix of the crew. Like I said, feels very Star Trek to me and something that I look for. You know, everyone is there for a purpose. Even some of them that are just brushed by, like, why are they on the ship again? It's like, I say that with Michelle Yeoh's character. It's just like, what, she's a botanist or not? You know, like, what's going on there? That's a soft spot for me, is that roles all have a piece of the puzzle, you know? And no spoilers, but there's some visual effects in this specifically used for like a type of sun radiation that is just such a simple but effective touch without CGI. I really just appreciated it. I mean, is it the most impressive thing looking at it in modern day? No. But I liked the challenge of, and I've really always appreciated about this film, that towards the end, this particular effect is used to avoid, I don't know, a gaudy CGI or fleshing something out, especially come 2007, where that feels like it's an artifact of early 2000s that we're getting these.
Yeah,
you got to
be careful.
They want to go crazy with CGI monsters and characters and concepts. So, but in a lot of ways, when I say I'm always on the hunt for deep cut sci-fi or the diamond in the rough, this is the type of movie I'm chasing. Something potentially overlooked, but has substance in its style, in its design, and specifically for sci-fi deep cuts, kind of, you know, doesn't forget about the science element. You know,
absolutely,
I mean?
Not. Absolutely not.
I feel like that's not always the case. Not to needlessly bash a different movie, but I feel like the creator with John David Washington kind of didn't hit that for me. Didn't hit the science.
Yeah, it didn't quite get there.
Yeah.
It wasn't completely fleshed out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, give it a lean towards Star Trek or something problem solving in space, I'm sold on it. I am sold. So, folks, if you're on the hunt for those type of gems like me, give it a watch, and hopefully I've been able to turn you on to something new, especially if you haven't seen it before. We're going to go ahead and give Sunshine 2007 a 78.
Wow. 78 is a very strong score.
Yeah. Definitely some leanings, you know what I mean? No, it's fair.
I'll say there's some disposition or predisposition towards it. But.
The funny thing is I knew about this film for years at this point because I was – I'll go down lists of what are underrated films, films that are great that no one knows about.
Yeah, yeah.
And two movies that always make it on lists I see, it's Layer Cake and this.
That's great.
You know, and they're two very good films. Yeah, so I've been
both coming from the UK.
And I think the Sunshine is – I think Sunshine is kind of getting – more and more people are finding out about it. And I don't know if it's because of Alex Garland or just Danny Boyle is such a huge name for so many years.
Or all these actors individually, you know.
That's true, too.
They all make it.
Even the one guy in it, the guy who plays the medical guy, Cliff Curtis, he plays, he's the captain of the Enterprise right before Kirk's dad?
Oh.
Or before Kirk?
In the remakes? The J.J. remakes?
Yeah, he's in the first... I
love to call back to those movies.
The Romulus kills him in like the first 5 minutes.
I was listening back to a recent episode and you dropped the prime directive scene in the second one where they're on the planet with the red aliens and whatnot.
That was like 2 weeks ago. It was 2 weeks ago.
I don't think it was 2 weeks ago.
Yes, it was. I'm pretty sure it was.
No, the other day.
Oh, no, it was the King Kong episode.
Oh, right.
I wanted the center Earth people to be more cool.
Oh, right. It was such a valid point, too.
Thank you.
Make these center Earth people.
Made a couple valid points on that one. 78% for Sunshine. Very good. And I think it's still sci-fi that's. And it's accessible, it's there, and if people just want a fresh sci-fi, because it's just, okay, I've seen Gravity so many times, Interstellar, I get it, put me on a ship with somebody different, go watch Sunshine.
And more importantly, I mean, this wipes the floor with Gravity. I mean, Gravity may be interesting cinematography-wise, but I like the character work here. I like the problem solving.
Yeah, Gravity was
space.
Totally over, and overly pumped out.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, that's a strong score, 78. Let's keep it going. We're jumping 7 years ahead in Ex Machina. Alex Garland is writing and directing this.
Mm-hmm.
Early role for Oscar Isaac as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is good. It's always good to see him. Let's get into it. What's it about? Set it up. And how'd you like it?
I really do love this movie. Full cards on the table. We're really into some movies that I've seen a lot of times. This marks the directorial debut for our boy Alex Garland. If I'm not sick of saying his name yet, you got to make a super cut of how many times I say sci-fi and Alex Garland in this episode. And seeing this around 2016, I couldn't be happier, especially because I was genuinely excited to see what A24 was doing in their business model in the early days.
Oh, this it is early like, A24, isn't it?
Yeah,
wow,
yeah.
I forgot about that.
I also, it's weird, this release says it's 2014. I don't remember seeing this even relatively until like 15, 16, so I'm not really sure what... the difference is online, or if it was, you know, like a Cannes release, like we always say, or something like that.
I'm sure it had I'm almost positive it had a festival release and probably a very small theater release.
Sure, sure.
And then all of a sudden, but you're right, because then all of a sudden people paid attention to it.
Exactly.
It must have been, it had to be when it gave birth new life when it came on to streaming.
Yeah, I think so.
You know?
That's a good point. And that's probably the case for a lot of those early, you know, A24 gems.
Yeah.
So, for many years, including Garland's next film, Annihilation, I considered him to be side by side with Denis Villeneuve as some of the strongest creative voices in science fiction during the 2010s. Also, I would love to add Neil Blomkamp to that list, but unfortunately he keeps on making movies that show otherwise. specific to Ex Machina, however, this was a sci-fi movie that instantly rocketed itself next to a impressive list of pure sci-fi movies, all with a chewy philosophical center. Not only does this deal with heady rationalist themes, a la 1999's The Matrix, the slower pace of the film allows us to explore how technology affects the characters and relationships with the characters in line with 2013's Her that had a similar AI focus.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely hot during this time and honestly shocked that it hasn't come back with everything that's going on with AI. Ex Machina is a scaled-down thriller that explores the Turing test through the eyes of Domhnall Gleeson, a high-tier programmer for a fictional tech giant company. He is invited to the estate of his CEO when he wins a mysterious contest. The trip feels manipulated from the get-go, constantly being shaken up by Oscar Isaac being this two-faced host, acting charismatic one moment and deeply unstable the next. He quickly reveals that the whole vacation is a ruse, introducing Ava, an advanced AI android beyond anything thought possible, and it's up to Gleeson to determine if this is all too good to be true.
I've probably seen this movie a good 4 times now.
Okay.
And each time I find I love Oscar Isaac more and more. With all the intellectual unpacking that goes on in the story, he's really key to building the tension in the moments. And without that, honestly, there'd probably be nothing keeping us awake, myself included. there's a lot of intellectual talking. I, of course, love unpacking that on screen. Mm-hmm. Love unpacking that through a sci-fi if, you know, it's going to have a purpose to why we're telling this type of story. But without him, I mean, the movie would be not only snail's pace, but also like a snoozer. Snoozer, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very small film. It's a very contained film,
yeah,
and a very quiet film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, Oscar Isaac is just more and more such a fan of him.
Yeah.
From the get-go, he just comes out of the gate, like, crushing it.
Yeah.
But I would say if you didn't have that twitchy eye, if you mm-hmm. the audience is sitting there trying to figure out, along with our main, how do you say his name? Dom Hall
Gleason? Yeah, it's Dom Hall Gleason.
Okay, that's also the actor's name.
Yeah.
Who's in, he's the redhead guy in The Revenant.
Yep.
Plays kind of the main captain.
Mm-hmm.
He's in other things too.
The Star Wars sequels as a very annoying Imperial officer. Right.
Nice. But anyway, if Oscar Isaac doesn't have that twitchy eye, if he doesn't make you think, okay, is he good and just kind of a recluse?
Yep,
and like a lonely guy, or is there something really wrong with this guy?
Yep.
It helps fuel it.
Absolutely.
And he's easy to hang out with on screen.
Yeah.
You're always engaged
with
him.
I also feel like it's key to the A24 vibes that this is, in fact, a thriller of sorts. You know, without that, if it was just this intellectual kind of psychobabble that goes on screen between a person and an AI, it would just, I don't know, we need that tension. We need that, is something wrong here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though the early moments, it doesn't really seem like that Oscar Isaac being this, kind of a psycho
CEO. Yeah.
I would say, you know, he's amplified to be a little cartoonish, especially in how much of a manic asshole he can be. But honestly, the older I get, the more realistic this character seems. He's like 30% Joe Rogan, 30% Elon Musk, and 40% billionaire god complex. And that's the character. This rewatch, I was able to even appreciate the different ways Alex Garland is able to build that tension as well. There's an infamous dancing scene in this that I've always kind of hated.
You hated?
Oh, first watch, I outright hated it. I thought it was like, what
30 seconds long.
What a depletion of the tension building. You know what I mean? What the hell is this?
No,
you know?
I liked it. It's one of the best dancing scenes of all of cinema.
it's literally
like 15 seconds only of dancing. That's it.
But I think that's where, on this rewatch, I was able to even appreciate aspects like that.
Yeah.
That, you know, I think I did watch this after watching Civil War. And I feel like, to me, he's trying to explore in his writing different ways to play around with how to shake that up for the audience. Sometimes it's not always horror or fear or like something really intense in visuals. Sometimes it's just something unexpected to shake that up for the audience and kind of create an unease. So it's not just limited to one thing. And I was able to appreciate that, specifically this rewatch. I really would have said I really don't like that dancing scene up until this moment.
That shocks me, honestly.
Yeah. You get where I'm coming from, though. It does kind of, the air gets sucked out of the evil tension.
I think
building.
For good reason. You're trying to figure out, is this guy good, bad? Is he just a weirdo kind of creep?
Right.
I'm okay. I was okay with it from the get-go.
Okay.
I really was.
Yeah.
I was loving it.
And it is a great dancing.
I mean, out loud, I'm going, holy shit, he's like one of the best dancers I've ever seen.
It is a really, really great dance sequence. Up there with Fred Astaire. My biggest curiosity watching this 10 years after release, how did the VFX hold up? Which were certainly cutting edge at the time. The early 2010s saw a wave of face animation advancements, and the work here was rewarding this production team with an Oscar win. It's so Oscar win.
Hmm.
This will also be something I hope to kind of do a little bit more of a deep dive on when we're covering, obviously, the coming Planet of the Apes sequel. And doing a little bit of a study of those 4 new films.
Yeah.
Don't have the expertise just yet, but I want to dive into what specific advancements were really driving that there. And of course, Andy Serkis is probably going to, you know, come up in some degree there.
Yeah, once when Weta kind of revolutionized and brought it into an acceptable acceptable form, it really took off like crazy.
Yeah.
And you're right, especially, well, then now, I forget when the first, I mean, we always bring back, not always, but we have talked about in the past, 2010's Tron, where they make a young Jeff Bridges, how much things get kicked off then.
Yeah.
And even bringing back, well, even what Star Wars did, bringing back like a character. It's
really... All at the maniacal hands of Disney.
It's really popping off right around this time. Just a real quick, too, I'm nervous about the new Planet of the Apes. Some of the stills and the clips, it's just like, it almost seems like they're backtracking in quality. Yeah. So I'm excited to jump into those movies and kind of jump around a little bit, but that's another thing.
I'll say I'm not nervous because I don't think it's going to be good.
Well, okay, very true.
But I'm with you. There's, I don't know. I'm definitely with you. There's some things that look lesser than what that series has been doing so far with these sequels.
Okay, but anyway, so back to Ex Machina, because what we're really doing here is because we have... How is it shot exactly? Because so people know you're dealing with robotic people, you know, robots essentially, but you have actual face and facial expressions.
Yeah.
So is the robot body CGI'd onto a real face?
Bingo. Or,
okay.
Yeah, it's basically just mapping the face onto a fully CGI body.
Right, okay.
Which, certainly that can be done for the reverse, everything but the face, but the complexity of the face is what the development is for, and what the recognition of the film is by the Academy. Watching today, I would say, don't get me wrong, I think a critical eye can definitely still spot... You know, some dicey moments. Yeah. Almost like looking at an old video game or something like that. But I still think it deserves a lot of praise because of how seamless the digital elements kind of blend together, even just beyond Ava on screen. That's where, if anything, when it's on Ava, you feel the cinematography so focused on her. It's so much the reason to watch in a lot of ways.
It doesn't take you out of it.
Right.
Because first time I watched this, it was like only a year and a half ago or something
that. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. I know. It took a while.
Interesting.
I even heard, and it was always referenced in like pop culture and stuff. Yeah. And I was glad I finally got around to it. But even just the setting of the film, too, how it's very, it's just on its own plot of land, and it's in like it's scientific rooms or just I don't know something
it's a
about
research facility. You know,
something about the whole setting it helps sell it a little bit. And the good thing is, even 10 years later, it doesn't take you out of it.
Right,
you know, you're still able to enjoy it and like watching this robot on screen. Essentially,
yeah, absolutely. But honestly, folks, it's really good. It's been good for a long time now, and I feel like if anything, there is some extra enjoyment. On reflecting our current state of AI and how this film kind of builds certain questions around testing how we interact as a relationship with artificial intelligence. Ex Machina stands as a high mark among sci-fi, but also a high mark among A24's now massive offering of films. And while many films throw out comparisons to the original Frankenstein, this film truly has the perspective, the insight, and the intelligence to rework that into a modern sci-fi shell. We're going to go ahead and give Ex Machina 2014 an 80 on the dot.
Wow, okay, 80%.
Big week.
These are high scores. I'm finding I don't... I'm not in love with Alex Garland.
Okay.
I think it just only makes sense that you're hotter on him than I am.
This is the Buzz Lightyear Woody complex.
Yes, it is. It is, yeah. I like him and I appreciate him. I would say this is the strongest film of his for me. I mean, I just watched it in the 2007, 14, and 18 films, you know, so I just got that core kind of sampling of his. And I would say his writing is totally the strongest right here. And even though this is kind of the most simplest film, I think I like this the most.
It certainly
personally.
Has the most heady themes, you know, most out there kind of mind trip type of type of
And it is really small.
Yeah.
I mean, everything about the film is small. And I don't know. This one works. This one works a lot. And 80% is a phenomenal score.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to kind of see where you put these here. So because I just kind of gave up how I feel about it, but we'll jump
in. What do you mean?
What?
You can say what you feel about
it. What I'm saying is Ex Machina is kind of my favorite of his. That's all. And you know, we're going to jump to Annihilation here. That's what I'm saying. I'm excited to see, you know, we'll see where you're at. But 2018, this is his directly next film, correct?
Yep.
Again, Alex Garland, he's making up the concept. He's writing it. He's directing it.
Yeah, writing and directing.
And we see Oscar Isaac again a little bit. Let's get into it a little bit.
Yeah, very different capacity.
Why don't you break this down a bit? We'll take it back and forth.
Sure. Well, in a lot of ways, I would say this is my favorite Alex Garland film.
Okay.
You know, I mean, is it a perfect film? No. I feel like even on release, I've had to kind of marinate on this a little bit. But without a doubt, I mean, I've seen this at least like 6 times with wow. so many rewatches. It ironically became difficult to write about this film. It's also a good example of the type of feel-bad vibes that I want out of sci-fi horror.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It not really ending satisfying, but also intentional in not ending satisfying.
That's so true.
Yeah.
And this is definitely sci-fi horror.
Yes.
You know, if it's ever going to be these two genres, I don't know if horror is ever slapped with any of these others. Mm-hmm. This is right in that pocket.
Yeah. I feel like he's always in this thriller zone because of madness. You know what I mean?
Literally,
He likes some madness as the, I don't know, the plot
the
mover.
The sub-genre.
Yeah, the sub-genre. right. This movie, to explain 6 watches, I don't know. I actually mentioned it in our men review back in 2022,
mm-hmm.
that it just kind of is an odd comfort food. I know that's odd to say as about a horror movie, but this was, especially with Netflix, just like a put on and have run in the background.
I don't know. I get it.
Yeah.
It is maybe not. It makes you feel so not good at times. But probably because it's, I don't know, it's a well-contained, well-made film.
Yeah.
And it's kind of newish, mm-hmm. and it's not quite, like, I don't put this as blockbuster.
No,
you know what I mean?
No,
it
no,
still
no.
has that A24-ish vibe.
Right, yeah. right. Where with Civil War, there's definitely an approach to try to make more blockbuster.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I feel like that's also in line with A24's goals, you know, going into, you know, the next, like, 5 years.
Oh, big time. I mean, Civil War is the most expensive film they made yet. Mm. Like, they're trying to get bigger and bigger.
Right, right. And so am I misremembering that they said they wanted to make more blockbusters or something like that?
Yeah. They want to expand. They want to expand and do more expensive films, basically,
exactly.
and bigger projects. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, this movie strikes a chord somewhere between its explorations of grief, its nod to other sci-fi deep cuts. Most of all, its terrific visual design that sparks the imagination. This is an adaptation of author Jeff Vandermeer's 2014 trilogy of books,
mm-hmm. yes,
referred to as the Southern Reach trilogy. And full disclosure, I've never read them because I'm a big stupid dummy when it comes to reading. So, on my list, but I got a lot of lists. You know, I got a lot of lists.
That's not true. You do a lot of subtitle reading on those animes, man.
Nice. The books include Annihilation, Authority, and Acceptance. The production story behind this one. Really weird, honestly. Almost like kind of bad.
Okay.
This has Garland writing an adaptation of the first book with no intentions to adapt the trilogy and even ignoring the other 2 books as they come out. That sounds like a red flag.
What do you mean ignoring them?
He didn't want to be tainted by a desire for re-edits, for revisions of the script, because I guess all 3 of these books come out in 2014. This is made in 2018, so there's time for him to marinate
saying.
On the story and where it goes for the author.
He just didn't give a shit.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was kind of a rabbit hole for me. I was like, what the hell is he thinking? Like, this sounds like what they're doing with like the Halo show, where they're not playing the Halo games to adapt the story. You know what I mean?
It's excellent. Like, yeah.
It's like, that's just backwards. In my research, you know, it's a very odd approach for sure, but in interviews, he speaks about making the film emphasize the more dreamlike experience of these characters, mm-hmm. of the novel itself, and not doing a straight adaptation. I personally think this could have gone very, very wrong, like horrifically wrong, you know?
Yeah, this could have been weak. This could have been the weakest tea.
Yeah.
Like late night sci-fi mm-hmm. channel crap.
Yeah.
Like 65 stuff.
Oh, sure, right.
You know?
Especially if it ended on kind of it ends on an unsatisfying note, but it's not a cliffhanger for future films, you know what I mean?
No,
and those
films
for sure. So it's definitely a little bit different there. But I feel like successfully he is able to match the madness of these characters and the approach. In the gaps in time that we see in the film. Mm-hmm. The stream of consciousness, obviously the true insanity that overcomes our characters. Annihilation stars my wife of many years, Natalie Portman.
Oh, okay. You're calling that one.
Yeah, she's mine. as a professor in cellular biology, and her missing husband in the story disappeared a year ago on a top secret military mission. That, of course, is Oscar Isaac. Stricken with grief, she is forced into the operation that he went missing in, where she is recruited as a specialist to study the effects of Area X. Referred to as the Shimmer, it is a field of energy with a rainbow-colored prism-like look to it. More importantly, it's rapidly growing, and the team of scientists studying it are at their wits' end trying to stop it. In a last-ditch effort, an unconventional team of five female scientists are set into Area X, a deadly void no one has come out of in over 3 years. I would say on release, the internet bashed this film a lot with the usual, like, oh, why is it a bunch of girls, you know, type of angle.
Oh, okay. All right.
And honestly, I feel like it couldn't be more wrong. Believe me, we have plenty of examples now of us dragging this trend, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've done the work. We've done the homework on calling heads or tails if it's, like, soulless and a cash grab.
Yeah, this was definitely not any of that.
Yeah.
It was funny when you had the five girls lined up, uh-huh. And they were about to walk into the Shimmer.
Yeah.
They totally look like the female Ghostbusters team from the back.
Yeah,
they've got like the backpack and they got the gun. You're like, it was pretty funny. But not going for any of that, no.
Yeah, yeah. And if anything, I would say it does add a slight element of there's a desperation to the research of this. Like they're at, you know, it's growing exponentially, Area X. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. They need to just do something different to
right.
it. And they have this tie with Natalie Portman and you know, her kind of connection to Who Went In previously. I will say it does not save some casting choices for me. Two out of the five of the crew really don't work for me.
Agreed.
Jennifer Jason Leigh, total miscast here. I mean, she just drags scenes down with her monotone bullshit. I mean, kind of looked back at her career. It's just like, I guess that's just her thing as an actress. Like, she just...
That's how she sounds.
One tone, yeah.
Yeah, she plays the main psychiatrist, so she's supposed to be like mellow-toned.
Mellow-toned,
is that even a word? Yeah, I kept on replacing. I think what would have been a good... Oh, what is the actress's name? The wife in Ozark. The main wife in Ozark.
Sure.
I think she would have done such a solid job on this, actually.
Absolutely.
But I want to go ahead with more casting because I'm kind of in total agreement.
I would say Gina Rodriguez is the next on the chopping block. Definitely could be annoying in just how cliche the role is, but also cliche the acting is as well. You see it from a mile away when it kind of sets up her kind of firecracker attitude towards the group. And if I'm being real, that's where... This maybe loses some realism in that, why are you sending in this team that hasn't worked together, that is kind of a secretive powder mm-hmm. keg to begin with?
Right, yeah.
Obviously, it's going to go wrong because it went wrong for everyone else. Those are my two on the chopping block.
I would say Tessa Thompson as well. Get her out of there.
Yeah,
I would say the bulk of, you know, Natalie Portman, and then there was one other female cast. I don't know. I just feel like the acting wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say about Ex Machina, and I think that's my favorite, that would be my go-to Alex Garland for me personally,
mm-hmm.
I think the writing is as strong as there. I don't think the writing is as strong on this.
Very true. And lacks certainly the intellectual spin.
When I think you totally could have it.
Yeah,
but true. I think between the simplicity of the writing for these characters and then the poor acting on top of it, it feels a little cliche-y.
Yeah, true. And as far as hopefully what I'm able to kind of get across is that I really do love this film. That doesn't mean I don't see the faults.
Oh, sure.
With it.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even very critically how the particular casting here can kind of harm the enjoyment and the aspects that I do like really love about this film.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want it to be balanced. But when it comes to the sci-fi, that's where I am in love with this film. Unpacking the sci-fi mystery of Area X and the Shimmer is the hook for us during the runtime. Realizing the exact horrors of this blooming rainbow-colored zone is really what it's all about. Now, I'm torn because I would love to just give one little spoiler, just as an elevator pitch to the movie and just set up the enjoyment of where I'm coming from with this film.
Mm-hmm.
But all I'll say is I want you to tune in, folks, to the exact effect of the Shimmer and how it's just this out there sci-fi concept to explore and pays off with its visuals in an awesome way. I'm definitely treading on what's been said critically about the film, but this has a wonderful callback to a lot of movies in the genre, deep cut sci-fis. The concept of Area X is very similar to 1979's Stalker, referred to as a sci-fi masterpiece by many, especially in setting its rules within a zone of the story, but also its own rules within the story once they're in the zone. And the source of the horror being themed around dread and madness, I mean, it really feels close to an H.P. Lovecraft in its unknown cosmic vibes. That's completely my bag. I can't tell you how much that in 2018, watching this on release, it was kind of like a convergence point of a lot of the stylings that I feel like we're building in science fiction. And really, again, pays off this style with substance in the sci-fi design of the world. I don't know. What are your thoughts on Area X and The Shimmer?
I liked it. I think there was a lot of things to like. I didn't dislike this film. There was a lot to like about the sci-fi aspect and where it goes and uncovering these things slowly. There's just the breadcrumbs that you're slowly picking up on. Again, I don't know. I guess I think it was a little bit hurt going into it with there being so much hype behind it and it being on one of my lists for 4 years now.
You even mentioned it in the old review in Men. You're like, you know, I've been meaning to get around.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And it's true. And I've been wanting to, and maybe I was expecting more punch. Maybe that's all. I think I was maybe for a little bit more theater and not realizing that it's, again, it's just this contained psycho thriller. This is sci-fi flick, kind of, you know,
sci-fi horror.
And so I appreciate a lot of some of this sci-fi aspects for sure. One thing I was thinking as far as double feature as well, and something to start with before going to this, would be Signs.
Oh, interesting.
Because it's more so something outer worldly is happening in a specific location, and it's just trying to figure it out. And of course, we have a climax at the end.
Yeah, it's kind of happening to the characters
rather than
them pushing it forward.
And this takes that to a whole new visuals. Actually, what's going on, the madness that sets in.
Yep.
You know, just things that happen. But
I think that's great. Yeah.
So I definitely had a lot of appreciation and for some of the design as well. I liked. Yeah.
Right. Well, I guess the real question is, would Mel Gibson added to this be better?
I think without question. I think you say that about a lot of pictures, actually.
It's just a scene with Mel Gibson at the table praying really hard, and it's just it's the same squad.
He's the one holdout in The Shimmer.
Yeah.
He's managing to make it. By the way, we got to watch The Beaver at some point.
I agree. I think that's definitely on a list somewhere, but probably was there since the first time I saw that trailer. But I think we're definitely on the side of giving him a shot. I think that's definitely apparent in Fat Man and things like that.
We don't have to be pleased with some of his actions in the past.
Right.
But in some ways have paid his dues that make it easier a little bit.
Sure.
I was reading about him a little bit, and there was stories that didn't make it out to press or that he kept quiet, but some people kind of let it out that this happened. And I was like, oh, respectable things happening. He wasn't doing it for cameras. So again, doesn't completely justify all of the words. All of the words that have been made on phone calls by him.
Oh, man. And those phone calls.
But he is, he is back in a little bit of way. I can accept his work.
Absolutely.
It's not like going back and watching Cosby specials or something.
Very true.
You know what I mean?
True.
There is a line.
There's
Overton window.
A very different experience that comes with that.
So what I'm trying to say is I liked the sci-fi elements of Annihilation.
Yeah. Almost as much as any Shyamalan movie. I'll end with saying this. The conclusion of this film is so fucking cool. Don't bleep that. The people need to hear it, Tom. So fucking cool. The subdued soundtrack of the whole film flares into this disturbing, almost psychedelic track. The horror is cranked to 11 as both realizations are made, but the unknown element really sets in. And it pays it off with such a weird, out-there concept that honestly is the whole reason why we watch science fiction in the first place. With that said, we're going to go ahead and give Annihilation 2018 an 81.
81, a great score. I mean, these are very well, very grouped together.
Right.
I told you, good score.
You know, pre-recording, a lot of this was just like, I just feel like this was like an Alex Garland ranking, you know?
it is.
Like all of his movies, but it's just about kind of putting it in perspective of where they all fall.
I wonder, it would be interesting to see if anybody else picks these books up for the future and tries to get that. Or like A24 grabs the rights and then passes it off to directors that they want or something like that.
Absolutely. It feels very odd. That production story, honestly, chipped away a little bit at my appreciation of the film in the sense that like this just seems like it could have been unnecessarily bad, you know? A slippery slope.
Right. Garland doesn't strike me as a guy. I mean, you know, Civil War just came out, and before the movie's even out and he's doing press, he's going on about how he's done with filmmaking, and he's like disenchanted and disheartened with it. Yep. Doesn't want to do it. It's just like, okay. Like, he doesn't strike me as a guy who would have any interest in any type of trilogy or locking himself down like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the movie, it's interesting that the books came out in the same year.
Yeah.
Because it seems so then it's not like, well, one was successful, so then these two came after.
Yeah, and the intentionality of ignoring it, I just feel like that's a recipe for disaster, you know what I mean?
Yeah, very strange.
But
it works on its own, for sure.
It does.
Again, what do you, just to highlight a little bit on the writing itself, because I kind of blame the bad writing completely on him. Obviously, he wrote the screenplay, but
100%.
You know, he didn't have to come up with the source material. That's already done for him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Something about the writing really felt, I thought, lacked from Ex Machina a little bit. Just my opinion. But
No, I agree. And I feel like it's been criticized of the film in the direct comparison that Ex Machina really, people I feel like were expecting something as cerebral as Ex Machina walking into this.
Right.
And
not that it wasn't, but
still a kind of an experience of a letdown.
Yeah.
And that, oh, okay, I guess it's just kind of one thing. And that's where I would say it really is more, it lets its genre speak in that it's a horror, its priorities are scares. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Where Ex Machina, as a thriller, can explore many themes and still kind of crank up the tension of a thriller.
Yeah, and honestly, and I mean, we're splitting hairs here, but even at 78 to 81%, it's splitting hairs. I mean,
exactly.
You really like these three films.
Yeah, that's where I kind of came into this week as well. I really did understood that I loved all of Alex Garland's work. I dig his style a lot. So it was just a matter of kind of putting in perspective where that all ranks for me.
Well, I'm excited to hear about the next one. But before we get to our newly released film now in theaters, we just want to remind everybody that Vin and I, the Daily Ratings, is operating off the value for value model. So we put all this together. We spent hours on this a week. We kind of put it out there. And the idea is that valuable to you? Are you listening to the podcast or stopping in every now and again? Are you checking into the website? Well, if you're using it, that's value that you're getting from it. It's value in your pocket. We ask you, can you give us value back in our pocket? So we're totally supported through monetary support, basically. If you go to thedailyratings.com and head to the donations tab, you can go ahead and send a donation in our way of any amount. You can just pick a number, and that's the idea. What's the value you're getting from it? We do have some set donations that are kind of fun, and if you just want to kind of click a button and you're good to go. But other than that, you're not going to see advertising. We're not going to do advertising on the podcast. There's not going to be tier structures or paywalls or subscriptions to all this. It's not pay to play. It's all out there for you. But, you know, it's a little bit, did you enjoy it? Are you getting value? Well, can you give something back? We certainly appreciate it. So that's why we call it the value for value model. When you do that, when you donate to the show, you are a legit actual producer of the Daily Ratings. You can send in a producer note. You can give us questions. You can just give us comments, critiques of the show. But we're going to read that note right here. We're going to address it here in the producer segment. You'll also get a mention in the show notes and on the website as well. So again, it's thedailyratings.com. Head to the donations tab and become a producer and send some value our way. We certainly appreciate it. Okay, Vin, with that, let's jump in theaters here. Totally, this is the most unlike Alex Garland for sure.
Oh, sure. Dropping the sci-fi.
We talked about, yes, and the blockbuster aspect. We just talked about it. A24, I think. I kept on hearing reports, most expensive, biggest A24 film. I was expecting like $100 million. It's still only a $50 million film.
right. I think that puts in perspective what A24 is working with.
And so when I watched some of the trailers and some of the clips, I was surprised with how big or how much land that we cover in the film because of the use for CGI. You know what I mean? And yep. I'm curious to see most how that kind of holds up.
Sure.
But also, Civil War, dive into it. You take it where you want.
Sure.
And I have some problems with the making of the film. I can't say much. I didn't see the film.
Yeah.
And we'll see if I should after this.
Right, right. Like I said in the beginning of the episode, when it came to the challenge of this week, sometimes that came from the fact that I've seen these films a lot of times. And it's like, sure. Well, how do I stay away from spoilers?
Yep.
Here, it was a challenge to unpack. Like we've talked about, you know, a couple times on the podcast, Bo is Afraid comes to mind, where it's just like, oh my God, this is just like,
wow, okay.
Like, how do I even begin?
When it's that big of a story.
No, but just such a strong vision from the director
okay.
that it's like, it's almost, it doesn't care what any critic thinks, you know what I mean? So how do I, as a critic, unpack that?
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
Let me give a quick shout out once again to our review of 2022's Men, Alex Garland's film in between these releases, as well as that mini-series Dev, or Devs, and a pretty diverse selection on that episode. We did A Scent of a Woman, we did some Netflix garbage, we did this, or we did Men, you know, wild episode.
We get around town on some of these episodes.
We get around town. I'm not in love with that review going back to it, but 100% stand by the score.
You had... I remember after you watched it, you were struggling with just like, I don't even know how to, like, because you didn't love it, but you could respect it in some ways.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's also another one where he sheds the sci-fi and he focuses on something more singular, that just being horror. I don't know
and
if
supernatural.
Yes, very true.
Yeah.
That I don't know if he could say with Civil War. Shedding the sci-fi is the theme, basically. Flash forward to this week, and folks, I cannot tell you how much I was equally hyped and dreading this movie for a lot of reasons in both directions. If it wasn't apparent already this episode, I love writer-director Alex Garland. You know, Men was a little bit of a letdown, but I was unsure where this would fall. If anything, I saw maybe a kind of a decline, you know, appearing in front of us, that Men was a slippery slope towards something that just wasn't his wheelhouse.
Remember what you gave Men, by the way?
I think it's a 69.
Okay, yeah, which for him is not, you know, it's a dip down for sure.
And for me, when it comes to this film... Man, the dialogue around it was just annoying in every direction. I will admit that some of that comes directly from the film, you know, with the concept and marketing leaning into controversy. Everyone on the internet just seemed to have their mind made up about this film, to quote the White Stripes, offended in every way. Now, much like we encountered with the pre-podcast 2019's Joker, these expectations are made without seeing the film. And if there legitimately is a hill that we die on here at the Daily Ratings, is watch the movie and let it speak for itself. Mm-hmm. If it's trash, believe me, it's going to be trash. You know what I mean? At best, it's art, and like all films, you should judge it by watching it. And at worst, it's a mid-budget blockbuster grifting tastelessly off of election year tension. Where you fall on that, even after watching the film, is completely fine, but I need to stress that Garland is approaching this with very different priorities than what the marketing has been suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
In the storytelling, in what the characters' roles are, and all of that is different than what appears on the surface. Civil War is a dystopia, near-future type of sci-fi, a subgenre well-explored by good and bad films alike, usually with some healthy distance between present day and the events of the film. This can be done with stronger sci-fi leanings, such as the extremes of Mad Max, or something more social like a Soylent Green, which we covered on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe we explore the setting a little closer to home and amp up that near-future aspect to the dystopia, an approach that has been absolutely done to death by the zombie subgenre. So hear me when I say that this might deal with touchy subject matters, especially in the year that it's being released, but it is purely in the realm of fiction and achieves a hyper-intense vision of the future for how it stylizes itself in modern-day America. And honestly, let's be real. You think audiences are going to stop gobbling up their doomsday prepper Americana just because it doesn't have zombies in it? No, yeah, right. They're going to eat this up. Everyone loves seeing, you know, the MREs and rifles on people and survival themes, Last of Us, Walking Dead. I mean, come on. Just because it doesn't have a fantasy zombie in it, it's still the same type of genre, and it's still the same type of visual design that's going on in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that will always sell.
Yeah, exactly.
That will always bring people in the theaters.
Right, right. The story of Civil War has us centered on four war photojournalists, and believe it or not, is almost structured. I might lose you here, Tom.
I'm here, though. Go ahead. I'll hold down.
You, yeah. It's almost structured as a road trip through post-apocalyptic America. Mm-hmm. We go through a lot of states, structured in a car. We'll call it Little Miss Sunshine 2024. Kirsten Dunst plays our lead, Lee Miller, who is actually a nod to a real photojournalist that I did a little research on. And about as seasoned as you get getting close to visceral combat. She's really like side by side with the boys when it comes to these squads and mm-hmm. understanding like SWAT tactics and hand signals and everything like that. Like really, really some intense stuff. The domestic war front is just as chaotic and brings in baggage of kind of a growing posse around her, trying to travel, trying to kind of be on her tail a little bit as well from a competition angle, other photojournalists.
Okay, positive, like a press pool almost. Yes. Just trying to siphon off of her, essentially.
Right,
okay.
She's hot shit. Other journalists are like, oh,
they want
to know she's going somewhere.
Right,
you
right,
know?
Yeah.
Youngest of the bunch is Kaylee Spaney, who we recently saw as the lead in Priscilla.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a little bit of a connection with Sofia Coppola because obviously, you know, she's very close with Dunst.
Yeah.
She plays kind of a morbidly dedicated rookie, looking to learn from the best.
Yeah, she looks young in this film.
Yeah. Younger, oddly, than Priscilla.
My thoughts exactly. Yeah.
but really enjoyable. I would say, I mean, all I can remember about Priscilla is that heart attack scare in the theaters. But
oh, that was Priscilla that
yeah.
they did. Oh, that's so funny. Oh,
but this is definitely much more of a standout role for
yeah,
her.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I expect, you know, these are two kind of big properties. Expect to see more from her, especially in the A24 space. Through this traveling structure, though, we get a lot of exposure to the world. It might be frustrating to hear for a lot of potential viewers of this film. The exact battle lines or the cause of conflict is blurry, treated as so common fact that no one really talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
And for the characters that are involved a little bit more knee-deep in the conflict, their priorities are on the conflict directly. They're not really like waxing poetic around how do we get here or something like
right.
that.
Right. We're not there at the beginning. We're there when things are already going
yes.
down. We're in it. Yeah.
The shit is in rotation, in the oscillation
yes.
of the fan. let's talk about what this movie isn't. And I feel like that's a good way to kind of approach, you know, expectation that literally everyone that has seen this trailer has.
Right.
It's not really about the politics. It's not about any single political issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the macro movements of the war either. Everything that looked to be super prominent in the marketing of the film, from that alliance map to sniper nest in the Statue of Liberty, all of that really doesn't matter. And we don't, more importantly, don't really see that actually in the film. That alliance map is a perfect example. It's on screen 2 seconds after like a news reel.
Right, right, yeah.
We're not there to unpack those issues in this film. To me, especially with focusing so much on Garland this week and his writing, I felt like the writing process for this started with the electric idea of a modern civil war and decided to be about characters that explore that setting. It's really just about using a really intense near-future setting and exploring that through war journalism. Does that kind of track?
I think so. I had listened to some other stuff and did some research on the film,
mm-hmm.
but I think what you set up there in the very beginning, which this is a bit of a road film,
yeah.
going kind of state by state in mm-hmm. just war,
yeah.
essentially, and it's about what this town is doing or what this state, how it's handling it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about the photojournalism or whatever, the journalists that we're following
mm-hmm.
In just a different war setting than what we're used to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Near future dystopia war setting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in that has some cartoonish elements to it. It is fictional in the sense that, like, I say it's strictly in the realm of fiction to kind of calm people down. Like, just, you know, it's just a movie.
Right, right, yeah.
But it's also in the sense that, like, this is just something foreign to all of us that he can explore this angle of, like, war photojournalism
mm-hmm.
And make it really intense as well, just as intense as anything we've seen this week. Not to sound like a broken record from last week, but this has some great character writing. The journalist-protagonist angle allows the structure of the film to be driven by piecing info together. The setting is the follow-through of that praise, having aspects like fog of war, asymmetric battle info, propaganda, all that being in play, this makes any investigator of the facts a valuable character to unpack the story. I guess what I'm trying to say there is that we're not just following journalists for the sake of journalists. You know what I mean? This is a valuable character role in unpacking what the setting is about and unpacking that as an audience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This also stylizes its action in a great way, using a combination of slow-mo gunfights punctuated by these freeze-frame moments shown through the shutter of photos or characters are taking, and usually at the most dramatic split second. I feel like the look of the combat is just so amazing.
Can we dive into that a little bit?
Yeah.
I almost wanted to touch on this with Sunshine.
Sure.
There are periods when Sunshine where action is happening, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden you think your screen is freezing because yeah. It literally just stops.
I legit thought there was something wrong with the screen. In watching Sunshine again.
And it's almost like this taking of the frame, basically. Yeah. That's what you're saying is done here?
Different. Very similar, but different. Okay. I feel like in Sunshine, that's an artifact of Danny Boyle trying to use like editing tricks in a digital way.
Okay. Didn't work, by the way.
Yeah, right, right. Exactly. Especially for it's like in the climax, too, when it's happening. It's like, what's going on? So I'm with you there. Here, it's stylized by literal like shutter of cameras. So we get like freeze frames in black and white of the photos that these journalists are walking away with. And it's in those split second moments, like a slow-mo, really emphasizes the action in a good way, in a nice, like satisfying, visceral way.
Okay, kind of surprising because slow-mo can be overdone and horribly utilized.
Yeah, absolutely, you know? Absolutely. And believe me, if it was something more gimmicky, I'd call it out right away. But yeah. I feel like there's a match in why we're experiencing these hyper-intense combat zones with photojournalists taking literal pictures of mm-hmm. it, why we're getting freeze frames. I also enjoyed the theme of what to capture. Is there anything taboo? Is there anything off limits in these journalist characters unpacking, you know, this state of America? Again, if anything, that's where there's an arc to the story. Because mm-hmm. again, we're not really getting a very satisfying arc of what's going on in this civil war. We don't really know sides. We don't know, you know, these aspects.
It's just chaos. It's kind of chaos mayhem.
The only thing we really have to go off of when it comes to that is that, you know, the president is tyrannical in some way and is entering into a third term. That's all we have to go off of. So when it comes to what the story is about, it's kind of about that theme of, is there anything too taboo to cover? And I feel, not to be artsy-fartsy, but I feel like that plays into a little bit of the experience of Civil War being this taboo movie released in theaters. That people are like, oh, why would you touch that? What are you doing there? I feel like there's an element there that plays into the experience of the film. I would say where I really start like loving this movie is in just setting and visual design. Kind of in awe of the movie. There were moments that I felt broke such new ground on crafting a rundown America. Again, your Last of Us, your Walking Dead,
right? Of course,
American Apocalyptia. You know, and visually distinct from those works, not just like, you know, Shedding the Zombie or whatever. He was able to kind of capture a very new look to dystopia America. Mm-hmm. This achieved a realism in the opposite direction for more stylized worlds, but it still has all the creativity. And I would fight tooth and nail on calling this kind of a fiction dystopia because there are a lot of cartoonish aspects to, what's our favorite word? The madness of the land, the craziness that is overtaking people. Conflict in the story rarely comes from real political issues, and is more about the American wasteland driving people crazy. The freedom, the no mm-hmm. rules. That's what's the driving force of a lot of what our characters are literally up against. They're not necessarily up against lines or forces. They're up against kind of the crazy weirdos they come across on this road trip. One of my favorite directors, Edgar Wright, actually posted about this film feeling like a John Carpenter film, and I think that's spot on. If anything, to the detriment, there are some cartoonish aspects that feel like a Escape from New York or Escape from L.A., and it's like,
oh, that makes sense.
Wow, this is like much more unrealistic than I ever expected. Right.
Delving more into the dystopian aspect.
Mm, exactly.
Sure, that makes sense.
And that's where I really urge, like, anyone that hasn't watched this film yet and has interest to watch it, just, like, it's a work of fiction. Like, just separate yourself a little bit from it, you know?
Yeah.
And believe me, I feel like the film makes that apparent through these cartoonish elements.
I think so. I think it's going to be different per person and how engaged it. However engaged you are in politics in real life is how engaged you're going to be with that in the movie watching it. How much you're going to seep in. I mean, just what you just said, tyrannical president looking for his third term. People are either going to be like, oh, yeah, I want to go see that. Fuck that asshole. Or the people are going to be like, yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's all however you want in real life or whatever politics you consume.
Sure.
You're going to let that consume you kind of in the film, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
You're very much are good at stepping into a screen and just being in the screen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's where I urge, like, the film also doesn't explore these issues at all. If there was substance or if there was time spent for these issues, I'd be saying a different thing. But I feel like, if anything, your critique of, like, Annihilation, it kind of loses its intellect. It's much more about action. It's much more about spectacle than unpacking issues.
I mean, how much of the... It really sounds like the film is just about war journalism, and he's using the platform of an American Civil War.
Bingo.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I think that's also, I mean, obviously I don't know his process or anything like that, but I feel like he sat down and he says, okay, what's an electric concept? Modern Civil War. How do we explore that?
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Right, yeah, yeah.
And hopefully what I'm saying there, like, understand the priorities of the film, never once tried to, you know, have a highbrow approach to say who's right, who's wrong. You know what I mean? I'm so happy that it avoids all of that, because I feel like that could be just a black hole of bullshit. You know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Bullshit that's going to age badly. And then also, like I said in the beginning, that's a little bit of the critique of the marketing and what this film leans towards into its controversy. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Especially when it's not about that, you know? It feels manipulative. But maybe that's the new A24. Maybe they're going to use all their weirdo premises to just get people in seats and then don't care about it. In a lot of ways, it just feels like Alex Garland was playing by his own set of rules here. You can look at this film and I would say even for how much it dodges the bullet of real political issues and unpacking that, kind of underwhelming. For chickening out of saying something substantial for either side.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this felt like some Tarantino rock star shit to me.
Wow.
This felt like 100% the vision of our director, without any studio notes, without any manipulation, without any other hand involved in it.
It's high praise. Like, that's high praise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The soundtrack is another area where this feeling kind of cropped up. It features deep cuts of proto-punk, like the late 70s band Suicide. And at first my note was like, wow, this music kind of all over the place. But like, again, it felt like a Tarantino movie in a lot of ways, where it's just like, oh, no one's just telling him no. We've explored on the podcast where that can be a crippling aspect with Bo is Afraid,
right.
Where it's like, oh my God, someone needed to tell him no. Someone at least chop this down in runtime. But here, it was something else. It was something much more like, wow, he's doing it. I really had a moment that I'll call kind of like a Baby Driver moment, where I'm like, damn, he did it. Can't do it now. You know what I mean?
Wow.
There's a couple moments where it's like, shit, he's the one that got
it. He managed to make this into something.
Yeah.
He took an idea that you're going to go, huh, geez,
yes,
roll your eyes at, and made it interesting.
Bingo.
Bingo.
Or even just like individual scenes, like taking a concept and then putting it in story.
Okay.
It's like, wow, okay, all right. That's a shame, because I really wanted to do that at some point in my career, you know, if I ever, you know, got to make a movie. Folks, if you enjoy stories like The Road, Last of Us for its travel component, or even Garland's own 28 Days Later, if you like this idea of a nightmare road trip that really is a roller coaster of tension and different tones of the film, and blending that in a trend that we've seen in a lot of big landmark movies as of late, that there is a fluid tone. Sometimes it shifts in and out of horror, tension, stakes, drama, romance, comedy. You know, it kind of exists beyond that genre. And maybe most of all, if you like Alex Garland, boy, is this a movie to watch. We're going to go ahead and give Civil War an 83.
An 83?
Yeah.
What?
Yep.
I really was not expecting that.
I wasn't expecting that.
Well, you must have been smiling the whole time.
More so.
That's a very good score.
More so, I kind of had a frown because, again, it was like, shit, I have to now explain why I like this movie.
Right.
You know, and where everyone would be so easy to say, ah, no, it's trash. You know what I mean? I now was like, damn, I really got to work now.
No, and I think it is getting conflicting things about it, too.
I've stayed completely away from the buzz on this.
I think it's a bit of a roller coaster. Okay. And I mean, like, when you take, like, I don't know, the critic class, kind of, like people who are actually doing it professionally,
right.
I think it's going kind of either way. Okay. And then you have some people who are just indifferent about it.
Yeah.
Some people hated it. Some people absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And 83%, I'm shocked at it because it's Alex Garland not doing sci-fi, and you love his sci-fi.
Sure.
It's his biggest film he's done yet, you know? So, I mean, that definitely intrigues me. We're getting something different, something that's going to make me say, wow, he did something with the concept.
Sure.
And didn't just do something ridiculously generic or something.
And I feel like that's the experience of the film as well, in the sense that, like, you kind of have to call it heads or tails. I mean, not getting rid of my job.
Right.
You know, my job is to kind of talk and recommend films, but this is definitely one where it's like, you kind of have to make up your own mind on this.
Wow.
Of how much maybe aspects bother and how much you're able to kind of take what he's putting down and only what he's putting down.
Is it as in your face? It doesn't sound like it is. As in your face are going to be as polarizing as a Don't Look Up?
I want to say less because it's...
I would hope so because...
Right.
Don't Look Up is a vomitus of both sidesing.
Yes.
That's a comment I've been hearing a lot about the film. Mm-hmm. Is it both sidesing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it's not trying to land down so it's not pissing you off?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Or is it... In that way, it's up in the air.
Right.
Or is it trying to exclude all of that and chart its own path?
Yeah, I think we're like, Don't Look Up is a satire that punches at all directions.
Right, that's both sides.
To its detriment, I feel like here, and again, maybe to its detriment, it avoids any punches. Mm-hmm. It avoids getting in the fight. You know?
Well, I mean, yeah, but an 83%, I mean, that's a good score.
Yeah.
You know, and if people are new to daily ratings or anything like that, just kind of checking into things because you're interested in Civil War, we just say it's very, not the easiest thing to get into the 80s with us.
Yeah.
There's only 1,200 films, there's like 11 or 12 that are cracked the 90s.
Mm.
So 83 is very, very good. And I can't imagine, one thing we haven't touched on too much with him this episode, he seems to, back to trimming the fat, the three films we just talked about, in fact, I think every single film is under 2 hours. Everything is around that hour 45, hour 55 mark. And for a movie that seems this big, for keeping it at an hour and 50, that I can't imagine hurts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You have not once complained about pacing,
right,
or length,
right,
or fat to trim.
And if anything, with like the beach and in your comments on Sunshine, like, could be longer, you know,
right? Right,
maybe
right.
Craving a little bit more,
but it's incredible. Ex Machina 148, Annihilation 155, Civil War 150.
That's a writer,
right?
That's a working man's true. Writer.
That's absolutely right. Another just real quick question: better photojournalist for movies, would you say Kirsten Dunst, Civil War, or ooh, Brie Larson in Kong Skull Island?
Wow. Phenomenal. I don't know.
some great scores here,
yeah.
Vin. Really good scores. You are definitely a fan of Alex Garland.
Yes, absolutely. But hopefully, legitimately kind of made my claim. You know what I mean?
Made my point. Oh, yeah.
You know, I'll be the first to admit it. You know, it's the sci-fi leanings of a lot of this week, you know, that's where I'm
it's
at,
just where you're at. It's you're the I'm, buzz in this podcast.
Right. This is a landmark moment of Buzz Lightyear for the podcast. July, we'll do Western Month, and you can be Woody.
I can be Woody, yeah.
I really do hope that it wasn't too crazy because I feel like, you know.
No, don't worry about it. Don't worry about that.
Because if anything, I really worked. There was a lot of long writing process on this one.
I love it, Vin. Love it. I'm glad that we did this. I love that we finished up Alex Garland. I mean, ooh, we have these studies that we do.
Yeah.
I hope maybe it could be difficult because some people just have no interest in this particular person.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not interested in this episode at all.
Sure. Or but even awareness.
Yeah. Right. It's great, though, I think, just getting all these studies down because it's really well-rounded then.
Yeah.
Especially for the site when you want to go back and look at all this stuff. It's all there for you. We covered them.
Yeah, we always talk about it, but like kind of a completionist angle on the site.
That's
I mean, it's a great way to put it. We want kind of a totality of like, hey, you're interested in this guy? We rank them all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
Harrison Ford coming up. any finishing notes here, Vin, or roll credits?
I will say one trailer note, not to hard sidetrack.
Go for it. Love it.
This Twisters trailer, every time I see it, it seems more like a comedy.
I don't love the trailer.
Like, I laugh at it more.
I don't love the trailer. I'm looking forward to the film.
Yeah.
There's some potentially wonky CGI.
Yeah, sure.
And yeah, comedy, maybe a little tough, Vin. Maybe a little tough.
It's just that last moment in the trailer where Glenn Powell is just like screaming with like the bay door open or whatever.
Yeah, very much reminiscent of Tom Cruise scream in The Mummy in the plane going down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What do we cover next week a little bit? If you want to give a tease us?
Yeah. Next week, honestly, is a little bit of a catch-up in itself already for April.
I already have
First Omen under my belt, Rebel Moon Part 2, The Boogeyman, The Ministry, which I thought was a Guy Ritchie project, but someone else, maybe he's producing.
Yeah, he's attached to it.
He's attached to all those type of movies.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm hoping to get in Monkey Man with Dave Patel. You know, I mean, damn it, I was calling everything John Wick before it was cool, but now that's really just John Wick, so...
Oh, is that what...
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, a lot of stuff like that, that I'm hoping to get to and not lose in the theaters, so...
Love it. No, a lot of that stuff, too, is going to stay, which is good, so... I think.
Yeah.
Excellent, Vin. Thank you so much for watching these films, doing your reviews, and stopping by here tonight. We love it. Folks at home, we'll run it down one more time. We have The Beach with a 59%. Sunshine with a 78, Ex Machina with an 80, Annihilation with an 81, and finally, Civil War with an 83%. So folks, thank you so much for listening. We will see you next week on the Daily Ratings Podcast. Hey, if you enjoyed the podcast, if you would, give us a good rating or get the word out and tell a friend about us. Just a reminder that Daily Ratings is completely producer-supported. We want to stay away from advertising, and we don't want to have any paywalls or tier structures or subscriptions. It's all just value for value. So, are you finding any of the value or any value in the things that we're doing here at the Daily Ratings? Then become a producer and donate whatever amount of value that is. Just go to the donations tab on thedailyratings.com, and while you're there, be sure to check out the massive amount of films that Vince has rated. Alrighty, folks, thank you so much, everybody. We'll see you next time on the Daily Ratings Podcast.